People of D.C. are united in wanting these escalated forces, Trump's escalated forces, out of our communities today. There are bills that would end this sooner rather than later. There are bills that would end it today. And we are asking for everybody's support to allies from around the country and around the world. Visit our website. Again, it's freedcproject.org/allies or /occupation and find out how you can help us, because we are very united that this attack on our people, whether it's our houseless neighbors, whether it is immigrants, whether it's anyone else, it needs to end.
Kaya Chatterjee, we want to thank you for being with us, executive director of the group Free DC. Coming up, the number. How much is Trump pocketing off the presidency? We'll speak with New Yorker investigative reporter David Kirkpatrick. Stay with us.
Who do you think you are? Plays us with his hate, turns man against man, but it's really not a game. And I pray to the ancestors' love, do not be fooled by this man's foolish talk. The serpent woke again in different times and places. There's a burning cross leading the mob, people in chains. He's a quack circus act creeping from the past. He's the symbol of the monster we no longer want to be. What we used to be.
Oh. Lila Downs performing Demagogue at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The number. How much is Trump pocketing off the presidency? That's the headline of an exhaustive new investigation published by The New Yorker magazine. In the piece, journalist David Kirkpatrick writes, quote, many payments now flowing to Trump, his wife and his children and their spouses would be unimaginable without his presidencies. A $2 billion investment from a fund controlled by the Saudi crown prince, a luxury jet from the emir of Qatar, profits from at least five different ventures peddling crypto, fees from an exclusive club stocked with cabinet officials and named executive branch. In March, Forbes estimated that Trump's net worth had more than doubled over a year to $5 billion. And a few months later, the New York Times estimated Trump's wealth had grown to $10 billion. But these estimates and others did not attempt to look at how exactly his fortune is growing. David Kirkpatrick writes, quote, although the notion that Trump is making colossal sums off the presidency has become commonplace, nobody could tell me how much he's made. I decided to attempt to tally up just how much Trump and his immediate family have pocketed off his time in the White House, unquote. Well, David Kirkpatrick joins us now in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Explain how you arrived at the number and is the period of time that he has made this money.
Well, what's important here is that I'm trying to be fair to the president. I'm not out to get Trump here. I went through and looked at all the sources of income, the income streams flowing into the Trump organization, the president and his family, and I asked, is this money that he would have made absent the presidency? Because he's got hotels, he's got golf courses. Sometimes people go there just to play golf or rent a hotel room. We're not talking about that. So I only wanted to look at money that he has made because he is or has been in the White House. And then I tried to ask as best I could, what is each one of those things worth? And that's how I came up with $3.4 billion. And again, I think what I hope will make this report credible, and the reason I urge people to read it, is that I've tried as best I can to be fair. I've shown all my work, and people can make their own conclusions.
And David, could you talk about some of the specifics from the small to the big? For instance, the ubiquitous MAGA hat at Trump rallies. Trump has a private store that sells these. Could you talk about that? And also the family's investments in crypto.
Yeah, the hats. I was quite surprised to realize that in addition to the campaign merchandise sold by his campaign, which all candidates and all presidents do, that's money that goes into the campaign coffers that he can't really touch for personal purposes. The Trump Organization also has its own online store, and they sell all kinds of Trump merchandise that looks very much like it's campaign merchandise, but this money flows to Trump and himself. You know, $20, $40 for a pair of flip-flops, a pair of beer koozies, a baseball hat. He's making, you know, millions of dollars. You know, I forget what the exact number was, but $20 million over the last few years selling this kind of merchandise, which is arguably competing with his own campaign and diverting some of the money that his supporters might think is supporting the MAGA movement and his candidates to his own pocket. That's the small end. Nobody thinks that anybody who's paying $50 for a baseball hat is actually going to get any influence, you know, over the president in return for that. That's just a way of making money. On the other extreme, there's significant amounts of money flowing into the Trump Organization now through its various, or the president's various crypto enterprises. Some of these, you know, predate his return to the White House. But I tried to look here at the, you know, all the money that they made off of the White House over the course of the two terms and the time in between when he remained a kind of kingmaker in the Republican Party. So, and most of it has happened during around his second term, you know, shortly before through his second term. In terms of crypto, you know, should I go through and break down all the ways they're making money off of crypto?
Yes.
Okay, well, here you go. So first of all, for people who might not be familiar with crypto, all it is really is a kind of online ledger or spreadsheet keeping track of who owns what. There's a number of ways that the Trump family has tried to take advantage of this new technology. He started out by selling NFTs, non-fungible tokens, which are basically sort of digital cartoons of himself. Then he moved on to setting up a company. His family, his son, set up a company called World Liberty Financial, and that's done a couple things. It sold a kind of token or online certificate that would ostensibly allow somebody to vote on whatever its future's plans in the crypto business might be. They raised, you know, $550 million selling those tokens, and 75% of that flows to the Trump Organization. Then it went into a new business selling what's known as a stablecoin. A stablecoin is basically the online equivalent of a dollar. It's not really an investment. It's just a kind of like almost a checking account. It's a way to transfer money here and there, perhaps more efficiently by doing it digitally. For the company, World Liberty Financial, they get to make money off of investing that money in treasuries while it's out in the world circulating as a stablecoin. So they go into the stablecoin business. Their first customer is a company owned by the United Arab Emirates that puts up $2 billion to buy stablecoin. While that money is out circulating as stablecoin, they're going to get about 4% a year on that, I calculate, by investing it in short-term treasuries. So that's a couple. There's a few others he's gone into. His meme coin is perhaps the most famous. The President Trump, right around the time he was elected, before he was inaugurated, went into this business selling a kind of online novelty, basically just a joke. It's a kind of digital certificate that just allows you to say, I paid money to own a little Trump novelty. That's it. That's all it is. There's nothing to it. And it doesn't even purport to sort of hold wealth, although you can trade it back and forth. He's made about $300 million selling those meme coins. And the last thing is a little bit of kind of a financial engineering that his company, Trump Media and Technology Group, a publicly traded company of which he's the chairman, a little bit of financial engineering that company has done. Now, that is the company that owns Truth Social. Truth Social is a very small online, you know, platform, social media platform. It doesn't have much revenue, maybe $1 million a quarter. It's never really made a profit. It doesn't have much chance of ever making a profit. And yet the stock that owns it, Trump Media and Technology Group, trades at a kind of surprisingly high price. And people on Wall Street consider it a meme stock. It trades basically on how people feel about President Trump. And in the last couple months, really in June, that company has done a remarkable thing, which is they have sold, they've issued new shares of stock. They've sold the stock at their inflated meme coin price, and they've taken that money and they've bought Bitcoin. They've also done the same thing to try to stockpile some cash. but they bought about $2.3 or $2.4 billion worth of Bitcoin, and they've stockpiled about $760 million worth of cash. So in the end of the last quarter, they said, look, we've got $3.1 billion of liquid assets on our books. So I calculate that since President Trump owns 42% of that company, he has an ownership interest in that $3.1 billion. So as I was doing this reporting over the last few months, my calculation of their net worth, of his net worth, bumped by, I shouldn't say his net worth, of the amount of money he's made off the presidency, jumped up by $1 billion.
Other members of the family, for instance, Jared Kushner and his daughter, in terms of the investments by foreign government sovereign funds in them and what that looks like?
I think you're thinking about Jared Kushner's private equity firm. So after he left, after Trump left the White House in 2020, his son, Jared Kushner, who had been in real estate, went into private equity, a new line of work, and he went to the Persian Gulf to solicit money, and he asked the sovereign wealth fund of the Saudi Arabia to invest. Their panel of advisors said this is a mistake. He doesn't have a track record in private equity, only real estate. There could be some public relations problem here. People are going to say this is a payoff to the family of a president. The crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who controls the public investment fund, overruled that and nonetheless invested the $2 billion with Jared Kushner's private equity firm. Since then, he's accumulated as much as $4.8 billion in assets under management, almost all of it from foreign sources, quite a bit of it also from the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. Under standard private equity terms, he would get 2% a year of that money as asset management fees. With Saudi Arabia, it's a little bit lower. But that is also, I'm counting, as money flowing into the Trump family coffers as a result of their time in the White House.
Can you tell us, David, about the family? I mean, in the first term, many of them were advisors to President Trump. They were in the White House. They would have to deal with ethics rules. We don't see that right now. So I'm wondering how the family business has changed from the first term to the second term. And I also wanted to ask you about, for example, President Trump says he struck a trade agreement with Vietnam. He'll apply a 20% tariff on Vietnamese imports, down from the 46% he threatened. The reported deal comes just weeks after the Trump Organization broke ground on a $1.5 billion golf course in Vietnam. A few questions there.
So during the first term, President Trump, on his way into office, volunteered that he and his family were not going to do any deals overseas because they didn't like the way that looked, right? It raises the specter that some foreign interest or even foreign government is going to try to buy favor with the U.S. government by paying Trump and his family privately. During the second term, the family has said, we're not going to do that anymore. We're no longer going to abstain from those deals. Donald Trump Jr. has said publicly, look, we restrained ourselves last term and people accused us of profiteering anyway. So we're not going to lock ourselves in, quote unquote, the proverbial padded room. We're just going to go ahead and be businessmen and do as many deals as we can. And they've done quite a few. Now, again, in my accounting, I'm not including deals which appear to be extensions of the business they were in before he was elected. You know, he had licensed his name for use on four condominium buildings around India before he ever went into the White House. Now there are five more Indian projects. Fine, let's leave that aside. That's more or less legitimate Trump business. On the other hand, since late 2022, when he was really the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, he's had a whole flurry of new deals around the Persian Gulf with one Saudi Arabian company, and that's in, you know, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, a couple in Saudi Arabia, and one in Qatar. And I don't think there's any way those would have happened without the presidency. And that adds up to, I would say, you know, guessing as best I can, the various income streams involved. That's more than $100 million right there in terms of its present value. You mentioned the Vietnam project. That's another one that I think, you know, would not have unfolded as it has were he not returning to the White House. That is probably, you know, physically going to be the largest Trump branded property in the world. Its planned size is about three times as big as Central Park, with 54 holes of golf. It's very hard to know how much the Trump family is actually going to make out of that property. On his most recent financial disclosure form, he said that the Trump Organization had already received $5 million in initial licensing fees from lending their name to that property. He's not going to build it. He's not going to own it. They're just lending their name and some management services. So I figure over 10 years, which is kind of a minimum term for a management or licensing agreement, he's likely to make at least $50 million with a present value of about $40 million. Probably it'll be a lot more than that.
And how much of this is, in your perspective, is legal, or and also how much of it is unprecedented for a president?
As far as I can tell, it's all legal. I don't have any evidence of a quid pro quo. I don't have any evidence of a specific instance where he has explicitly sold a public favor for personal profit. And the remedy that our laws prescribe for potential conflicts of interest is disclosure. Elected officials disclose what they own and how they're making money, and the voters or the Congress can decide what's appropriate or inappropriate. And I guess we'll have to see how voters feel about that. The other part of your question, I think, was what again?
How much of this is unprecedented for a president?
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of that's been widely reported. There's nothing like this before, right? A lot of presidents make money after they leave, selling books, you know, various other endeavors. But he and his family are making this money while he's in the White House, and the scale is really quite novel.
And in the last 10 seconds, you talk about the frenzy.
Well, that's right. What really surprised me about all this is just how fast they're making this money. They seem to turn down no opportunity. And that's what makes the questions about a conflict of interest all the more pressing, because I feel like when they are so evidently zealous, so eager to make money, it really sharpens the question of what a buyer, so to speak, might be getting for that.
David Kirkpatrick, I want to thank you so much for being with us, reporter with The New Yorker. We'll link to your piece, The Number. How much is Trump pocketing off the presidency? Coming up, immigrant detainees held at the so-called Alligator Alcatraz in Florida are stuck in a legal black hole. So says the ACLU, which has taken the Trump administration to court. Back in 20 seconds.
Man built a railroad, man got a move. Man made a record, put a needle to the groove. Man been up, oh, and man been down. Now man don't want no one around. Well, first they stole our language, then they stole our names, then they stole the things that brought us fame. And they stole our neighbors, and they stole our streets, and they left us to die on Recon Beach.
Recon Beach by Linda Sagata of Hooray for the Riff Raff, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at what Republicans have dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, that recently opened immigration jail in the Florida Everglades. This is President Trump speaking during a tour of the jail in July.
You know, snakes are fast, but alligators are big. We're going to teach them how to run away from an alligator, okay? If they escape prison, how to run away. Don't run in a straight line. Run like this. And you know what? Your chances go up about 1%. Okay? Not a good thing. We have a lot of bodyguards and a lot of cops that are in the form of alligators. You don't have to pay them so much. But I wouldn't want to run through the Everglades for long. It will keep people where they're supposed to be. This is a very important thing.
Monday, A federal judge in Miami heard arguments in a federal lawsuit brought on behalf of people detained at the immigration jail, built out of temporary tents, trailers, chain-link fences with barbed wire, located in an area of the Everglades at high risk of flooding. Lawsuit alleges immigrants at the jail have been routinely subjected to human rights abuses and denied due process. The case brought by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Florida, and Americans for Immigrant Justice. We go right now to Eunice Cho, senior counsel at the ACLU National Prison Project, lead attorney in the federal lawsuit who argued in the Miami courtroom. Can you explain what took place on Monday, what you're suing over, and how the judge responded, Eunice?
Well, thanks, Amy. We brought this lawsuit because people who are being held at Alligator Alcatraz have had very little and limited access to talk to their attorneys, and Until this weekend, we're unable to file bond petitions to request release from custody. Now, as you know, these are basic constitutional rights that are afforded to anybody that is held in government custody. And what was happening at Alligator Alcatraz is simply unprecedented and not normal. What happened on Monday is that we actually secured a very important victory. Because of the lawsuit, the federal government has decided that they're going to reverse course, and they are now allowing immigrants who are held at Alligator Alcatraz the ability to petition the immigration court for release from detention, which is something that the government should have never been able to do in the first place. And I just have to underscore, it shouldn't take a lawsuit to force the government to abide by the law and by the Constitution. The court order also transferred the case to another federal court in the Middle District of Florida, closer to where the facility is located. So now that court will issue a decision regarding the right of access to counsel at the facility. And we look forward to continuing that fight.
And Eunice, could you talk about the difficulties that lawyers have had in reaching their clients and also family members being able to visit?
Well, that's a very good question. At the very beginning of this lawsuit, there was no attorney access whatsoever. We had attorneys who were trying to visit their clients who would go to the facility, and like any other facility in the United States, normally you would be able to walk into the facility, show your identification card and your bar card. But here it was completely different. Attorneys were met at military checkpoints by armed guards and turned away from the facility, being told that they could try to email an address to request a visit. When people were trying to email those email addresses, everything was bouncing back. There was no ability to get in touch with clients at all. After we filed the lawsuit, the Governor DeSantis said that the facility would start allowing limited attorney access at the facility. There have been some attorneys who've been able to visit their clients in person, but there have also been many attorneys who've never actually had the chance to meet with their clients there because the delays have been so lengthy. One person had been detained at the facility for over a month, and despite repeated requests for an attorney visit, that still didn't happen. Families, of course, are not able to visit anyone at the facility, and the only way that people can communicate with their families is via a monitored, recorded phone line where people can really only speak to their families for a few minutes at a time.
And your lawsuit also seeks to force the government to provide information about who is being held and where. Talk about the way that the government was disappearing people or has been disappearing people.
Well, that's a great question. Usually when somebody is held in immigration detention, there is an online locator system where people's names show up and you can see where people are being held in detention. And as you can imagine, if your family member has been taken by ICE and put into detention, they could be held at over 150 detention facilities nationwide. And it is so important to know where they are so that you can establish contact, so the attorneys can get in touch to help defend their cases. And here at Alligator Alcatraz, ICE has simply not been recording anybody who is being held at the facility. So even if you enter their name in the system, there's simply no result, which is profoundly disturbing when people are just being whisked off the streets. We have stories of people who were picked up in front of their churches, people who are on fishing trips with their families, people who are driving home from work, being pulled over by the highway patrol and then transferred into immigration custody. People are being pulled over for the quote unquote offense of being brown. And this really is a huge pattern of what is happening with this facility at Alligator Alcatraz.
Eunice Cho, you've hired highlighted the story of a man with disabilities who was forced to sign a document that turned out to be voluntary deportation form. Explain what happened.
Well, you know, one of the big problems with what's happening at Alligator Alcatraz is that guards are going cell to cell, asking detainees or pressuring detainees to sign voluntary departure orders, really taking advantage of the very desperate conditions in which people are in. And all of that is happening without the ability to contact counsel about the very momentous decision that this represents. And we are hearing of cases of people who have valid claims to stay in the United States, even have court dates scheduled, who are signing these voluntary departure orders because they don't know what they're doing. And I think a very good, clear example of this is the story of an intellectually disabled person who was held at Alligator Alcatraz. Guards told him he was signing a piece of paper in order to get a blanket. And in fact, he was signing a voluntary departure order and was deported only a few days later. The other abuses that are happening at Alligator Alcatraz just continue. We heard a story of a person who was denied a bond hearing. His bond hearing was canceled. And a few days later, even though he was still actively in immigration proceedings, has not received a final order of removal from the United States, was wrongfully deported from the United States to Guatemala. And he still remains there today, despite many attempts from his attorneys to have him returned back to the United States. This is just the type of harm that is resulting as a result of these constitutional violations that are taking place at Alligator Alcatraz.
And Eunice Cho, this detention camp was built in complete secrecy. You talk about the state of Florida never holding a public hearing or obtaining local approval or going through an environmental review process before appropriating this land and building this facility?
Well, everything about this facility is not normal. It is not precedented. And it is still somewhat unclear as to what the exact legal authority that it gives the state of Florida to be establishing this facility and holding people at the facility. And as you mentioned, the process in which the facility was built, it was so rushed. It went without environmental review. Our friends at Earth Justice and Friends of the Everglades have also brought a separate lawsuit challenging this reckless plan to build a massive detention center in the heart of the Everglades without going through any environmental review as required by law. And so another federal court, of course, is deciding that issue as we speak.
I wanted to ask you about the bigger picture. You are senior counsel at the ACLU National Prison Project. Washington Post reporting ICE is planning to double its detention capacity to jail more than 100 immigrants. ICE has already expanded its jails, plans to open more around the country. Another one in Florida, including in Nebraska, right near Lincoln, a prison so-called war camp dubbed by Republicans Cornhusker Clink. Overall, how are you dealing with all of these and the corporations, the private prison companies that are profiting?
Well, I think this is profoundly disturbing, and I think this is unprecedented in nature. ICE has received $45 billion from Congress, $45 billion to expand the nation's immigration detention infrastructure. And to put this in perspective, last year, ICE received $4 billion for immigration detention. This amount of money will allow ICE to more than double the size of the immigration detention system in less than 6 months and expand it to a carceral system that's larger than the entire federal prison system. They are planning to detain over 100,000 people per day. And I want everyone to think about what is being built with these funds. While we're contending with historic cuts to Social Security, healthcare, education, veterans benefits, cancer research, these funds are being used to build detention centers around the country to lock up families, neighbors, and our coworkers in these facilities as we speak. Not only is ICE planning to enter into contracts with private prison companies who are going to overwhelmingly benefit from this expansion. It is also planning to expand detention in military bases with tent camps, as well as local, state, and prisons, federal prisons that have gone empty for years. This is an expansion of disastrous proportions.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Eunice Cho, senior counsel at the ACLU National Prison Project, lead attorney in the federal lawsuit. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
See CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Supported and empowered by the students of SFU and listeners like you. For your community, by your community. You are CJSF.
The Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created by the Unison Fund to support Canadian music industry veterans. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.